Osho Talk. Yoga, the Supreme Science, Number 1.
Now begins the last section of Patanjali's suttas, Kavalyapada. The powers are revealed at birth, or acquired through drugs, repeating sacred words, austerities, or samadhi. The transformation from one class, species, or kind into another is by the overflow of natural tendencies or potentialities. The incidental cause does not stir the natural tendencies into activity. It merely removes the obstacles. Like a farmer irrigating a field, he removes the obstacles and then the water flows freely by itself. Artificially created minds proceed from egoism alone. Though the activities of the many artificial minds vary, the one original mind controls them all.
Man is almost mad. Mad because he is seeking something which he has already got. Mad because he is not aware who he is. Mad because he hopes, desires, and then ultimately feels frustrated. Frustration is bound to be there, because you cannot find yourself by seeking. You are already there. The seeking has to stop. The search has to drop. That is the greatest problem to be faced, encountered. The problem is that you have something and you are seeking it. Now how can you find it? You are too much occupied with seeking and you cannot see the thing that you already have. Unless all seeking stops, you will not be able to see it. Seeking makes your mind focus somewhere in the future. And the thing that you are seeking is already here, now, this very moment. That which you are seeking is hidden in the seeker himself. Seeker is the sought. Hence so much neurosis, so much madness. Once your mind is focused somewhere, you have some intention. Immediately, your attention is no more free. Intention cripples attention. If you are intently looking for something, your consciousness has narrowed down. It will exclude everything else. It will include only your desire, your hope, your dream. And to realize that which you are, you need not have any intention, you need attention. Just pure attention, not intending to go anywhere. Unfocused consciousness. Consciousness here now, not anywhere else. This is the basic problem. The dog is chasing its own tail, gets frustrated, gets almost mad, because each step and nothing comes into hands, only failure, failure, failure. Just the other day, a sannyasin told me that he is feeling now frustrated. I became tremendously happy. Because when you feel frustrated, there opens something within you. When you feel frustrated, if really frustrated, then future disappears. Future can exist only with the support of expectation, desire, intention. Future is nothing but intentionality. I became tremendously happy that one man is frustrated. Fritz Perls, one of the very perceptive men of this century, has said that the whole work of the therapist is nothing but skillful frustration, creating frustration. What he means? He means unless you are really frustrated with your desires, hopes, expectations, you will not be thrown back to your own being. A real frustration is a great blessing. Then suddenly you are, and there is nothing else. The sannyasin said, I am feeling frustrated, it seems that nothing is happening. I have been doing all sorts of meditations, all sorts of group therapies, and nothing is happening. That's the whole point of all meditations and all group therapies, to make you aware that nothing can happen. All has happened already. In deep frustration, your energy moves back to the source. You fall upon yourself. You will try to create new hope. That's why people go on changing their therapists, their therapies, their masters, gurus, religions. They go on changing because they say, now I'm feeling frustrated here, somewhere else I will again sow new seeds of hope. Then you will be continuously missing. If you understand the problem is how to throw you upon yourself, how to frustrate you in your desires, of course it has to be very skillful. That's what I'm doing here. If you don't have any desires, first I create them. I give you hope. I say, yes, soon something is going to happen. Because I know desire is there, but not full-fledged. It is there, hiding in a seed form. It has to sprout. It has to flower. And when the desire flowers, those flowers are of frustration. Then suddenly you drop the whole nonsense, the whole trip. And once you are authentically frustrated, and when I say authentically, really frustrated, I mean that now you don't start any other hope again. You simply accept it and you return back home. You will start laughing. This is what you were seeking always. And it has been always inside you, but you were too much occupied with seeking. There is a very beautiful movie called The King of Hearts. The context is World War I, and the Germans and the English are fighting over a French town. The Germans plant a time bomb and leave the town. And the French learn about the bomb and they also leave the town. All the people in the insane asylum come out and take over the empty town and have a wonderful time. Because nobody is left there, only the insane people in the insane asylum. Even their guards have escaped. So they are free. They come out of the town and everything is empty. Shops are empty, offices are empty. So they take over the town. They take over the empty town and have a wonderful time. They all put on different clothes and enjoy themselves thoroughly. Their madness simply disappears. They are no more mad. Whatsoever they wanted always to become and could not become, now they simply become without any effort. Somebody becomes the general, and somebody becomes the duke, and somebody the madam, and somebody else doctor and the bishop. Whosoever wants to become, everything is free. They put on a different clothes and enjoy themselves thoroughly. Everyone takes on some role in the town: general, duke, lady, madam, bishop, etc. One guy becomes a barber, and he pays customers because he enjoys being a barber, and he gets more customers that way. They all are living these roles, living in the moment and enjoying it completely, utterly. A British soldier is sent to the town to disable the bomb. He gets frustrated because he cannot find the bomb where it has been put, and he starts ranting and raving and shouting, "We are all going to die." So everyone, the general, the duke, the bishop, the mad people. So everyone brings lawn chairs to watch him perform, and they clap and they cheer. Of course, he gets even more mad. The next day, both the Germans and the British march back into the town, and all the crazy people treat it as a parade. Then the soldiers see each other and shoot and kill each other. The duke, up in a balcony, looks down at all the bodies disdainfully and says, "Now they are overacting." A young woman looks down sadly and says, with puzzlement, "Funny people." And the bishop says, "These people certainly have gone mad." You think mad people are mad? Just look at yourself, what you are doing. You think when a madman pretends that he is the prime minister or the president, he is mad, then what your presidents and prime ministers are doing? In fact, they may be more mad. Because the madman simply enjoys the fantasy. He does not bother to make it an actuality. But the premiers, the presidents, and the generals, they have not remained satisfied with their fantasy. They have tried to actualize it. Of course, when a madman is an Alexander or Genghis Khan, he never kills anybody. He simply is. He does not go to prove that really he is. He is not dangerous. He is innocent. But when these so-called sane people have the idea of being a Alexander, Genghis Khan, Temurlang, then they don't remain contented with the idea. They try to actualize it. Your Adolf Hitlers are more mad. Your Mao Zedongs are more mad than any mad people in any mad asylum. The problem is that the whole humanity exists as if under a certain hypnosis, as if you all have been hypnotized. and you don't know how to get out of it. All our lifestyles are insane, neurotic. They create more misery than they create happiness. They create frustration than they create any fulfillment. The whole way you live brings you more and more closer and closer, nearer and nearer to hell. Heaven is just a desire. Hell is almost a reality. You live in hell and you dream about heaven. In fact, heaven is a sort of tranquilizer. It gives you hope. But all hopes are going to be frustrated. The hope of heaven simply creates a hell of frustration. Remember this. Only then you will be able to understand Patanjali's last chapter, Kaivalya Path. What is the art of liberation? The art of liberation is nothing but the art of de-hypnosis. How to drop this hypnotic state of mind? How to become unconditioned? How to look at reality without any idea creating a barrier between you and the real? How to simply see without any desires in the eyes? How simply to be without any motivation? That's all yoga is about. Then suddenly that which is inside you and has always been inside you from the very beginning is revealed. The first sutra. Janam Aushadhi Mantra Tapa Samadhija Siddhya. The powers are revealed at birth. This is a very pregnant sutra. And I have not come yet across a right commentary about this sutra. Because it is so pregnant that unless you penetrate it to the very core, you will not be able to understand it. The powers are revealed at birth, are acquired through drugs, repeating sacred words, austerities, or samadhi. Whatsoever you are is revealed at birth without any effort. Every child, while he is being born, knows the truth because he has not yet been hypnotized. He has no desires. He is still innocent virgin, not corrupted by any intention. His attention is pure, unfocused. The child is naturally meditative. He is in a sort of samadhi. He is coming out of the womb of God. His life river is yet absolutely fresh, just from the source. He knows the truth, but he does not know that he knows. He knows it, not knowing that he knows it. The knowledge is absolutely simple. How can he know that he knows? Because there has never been a moment of not knowing. To feel something as if you know it you have to have some experience of non-knowledge. Without ignorance, you cannot feel knowledge. Without darkness, you cannot see stars. In the day, you can't see the stars because it's all light. In the night, you see the stars because it is all dark. Contrast is needed. A child is born in perfect light. He cannot feel that this is light. To feel it, he will have to pass through the experience of darkness. Then he will be able to compare and see and know that he knows. His knowledge is not yet aware. It is innocent. It is simply there as a matter of fact. And he is not separate from his knowledge. He is his knowledge. He has no mind. He has simple being. What Patanjali is saying is this, that what you are seeking, you had known before. Not knowing it, you have known it before. Otherwise, there is no way to seek it, because we can seek only something which we have known in some way, maybe very dimly, vaguely. Maybe the awareness was not clear, it was clouded in mist. But how can you seek something which you have not known before? How can you seek God? How can you seek bliss? How can you seek truth? How can you seek the Self, the Supreme Self? You must have tasted something of it. And that taste and the memory of that taste is still somewhere treasured within your being. You are missing something, that's why search, seeking arises. The first experience of samadhi, the first experience of infinite power, siddhi, of potentiality, of being a god, is revealed at birth. But at that time, you cannot make it a knowledge out of it. For that, you will have to go through a dark night of the soul, and you will have to go astray. For that, you will have to sin. The word sin is very beautiful. It means simply going off track, missing the right path, or missing the target, missing the goal. The Adam has to go out of the Garden of Eden. It is a necessity. Unless you miss God, you will not be able to know Him. Unless you come to a point where you don't know whether God is or is not, unless you come to a point where you are miserable in pain and anguish, you will never be able to know what bliss is. Agony is the door of ecstasy. Patanjali's first sutra is simply saying that whatsoever is attained by the yogis is nothing new. It is a recovery of something lost. It is a remembrance. That's why in India we call, when once somebody attains samadhi, we call it is a rebirth. He is reborn. We call him Dvija, twice born. One birth, was unconscious, the first birth. This second birth is conscious. He has suffered, gone astray, come back home. When Adam returns home, he is Jesus. Every Jesus has to go far away from the home. Then he is Adam. When Adam starts the returning journey, he is Jesus. Adam is the first man, Jesus the last. Adam is the beginning, the Alpha, and Jesus the end, the Omega. And the circle is complete. The powers are revealed at birth. Then arises the world, what Hindus call Maya. It has been translated as illusion, as magic, but the best way to translate will be hypnosis. Then arises the hypnosis. Thousand and one hypnosis is all around. He is being taught that he is a Hindu. Now it is a hypnosis. He is being taught that he is a Christian. Now it is a hypnosis. Now his mind is being conditioned and narrowed down. He is a Mohammedan. It is a hypnosis. Then he is taught that he is a man or a woman. It is a hypnosis. 90% of your manhood or womanhood is simply hypnosis. It has nothing to do with your biology. The biological difference between man and woman is very simple, but the psychological difference is very complicated and complex. You have to teach small boys to be boys and small girls to be girls, and you bifurcate them. You create an intention. The girls are going to become beautiful women, and the boys are going to become very powerful men. The girls are going to be just confined in the home, householders, housewives, mothers, and the boys going on a great adventure in the world. Money, power, prestige, ambition. You create different intentions in them. In different societies, different conditionings are given. There are societies which are matriarchal. The woman is predominant. Then you will be seeing an unbelievable truth there. Whenever there is a society in which the woman is predominant, man becomes weak and woman becomes powerful. And she manages all outside work and the man simply looks after the home. But because we live in a man-dominant society, man becomes powerful and woman becomes weak and fragile. But this is a hypnosis. It is not natural. It is not so in nature. You give a certain direction. Then thousand and one sorts of hypnosis go around. In India, if a man is born in a poor, untouchable family, is a Sudra, he is confined to being a Sudra for his whole life. He cannot even change his business. He cannot become a Brahmin. He is confined. A very narrow hole, a tunnel-like hole is given to him. He has to go through that. No other alternatives available. And he will think in those terms and he will live a certain style of life. and each conditioning of the mind is self-perpetuating. It goes on creating itself more and more skillfully. Then you are given ideas about God. In Soviet Russia, you are given the idea that there is no God. Stalin's daughter Svetlana has written her memoirs that from the very beginning, of course, she was Stalin's daughter, so she was taught very strictly to be an atheist. But by and by, she started feeling, why, if there is no God, why there is so much propaganda against him? What is the point? There is no point in it. If God is not there, finished. Why be worried? Why create anti-God propaganda, literature, this and that? Why try to prove? The very effort shows that something seems to be there. Something may be there. She became suspicious. And when Stalin died, she revolted. She became a religious person. But her mind was narrowed down. She must be a very rare human being. Because to be a theist in Soviet Russia is as difficult as to be an atheist in India. These things are not taught, these things are caught with the blood of the mother, with the milk of the mother, with the breathing of the mother. Your whole atmosphere surrounds you as a subtle conditioning. These things are not taught. Nobody is teaching you these things in particular. You catch them. A Hindu child, the first thing he hears when he opens his eyes and his ears hear, the first thing is going to be a mantra or something from Bhagavad Gita. He does not understand anything, but the first impact is of Sanskrit. The first impact is of some religious scripture. Then he starts growing. He sees his mother praying. The statues of gods and flowers and incense. And he also goes on crawling there and watches and sees what is happening. And he can see that the mother is crying and tears are coming. And she looks so happy and so graceful. Something tremendously great is happening. He cannot know what it is, but something is happening. He is catching. Then the temple, then the priest, then the robes, flamboyant, and the whole atmosphere. And he goes on drinking the atmosphere. It becomes part of his being. Either from the mother's breast or from the state's breast. But these things are just caught up unawares. You become a Christian. By the time you become alert, you are already a Christian, a Hindu, a Mohammedan, a Jaina, a Buddhist. And it is very difficult to uncondition it. The whole effort of Patanjali is how to uncondition you, how to help you so that you can yourself uncondition all that has been given to you. Has to be dropped so that again you come out of the clouds into the open sky, so that again you come out of this small tunnel-like existence of being a Hindu, Mohammedan, this and that, a communist. How to find the open sky again, dimensionless? No religion particularly no organized religion is in favor of it. They decorate their tunnels. They force things on people as if that is the only way to reach to God. I have heard about a man, a Protestant who died, who reached to heaven. He asked Saint Peter that first, before he settled somewhere, he would like to have a tour around. He would like to see the whole heaven. Saint Peter said, "Your curiosity is understandable, but one thing you have to remember. I will take you around, but don't talk and be completely quiet and walk so that no noise is made." The Protestant was a little worried, why so much? But they walked. And whenever he wanted to say anything, Saint Peter will put his finger on his lips and will say, "Shh, keep quiet." When the tour was over, he asked, "What is the matter? Why so much quietness?" He said, "Everybody here believes, for example, the Catholics believe only they are in heaven. The Protestants believe only they are in heaven. The Hindus believe only they are. The Mohammedans believe only they are. So they feel very much offended if they come to know that somebody else is also there. That is impossible for them to believe. On the earth also people live in tunnels, and in heaven also. No organized religion can be in favor of a totally open mind. That's why an organized religion is not a religion at all, it is a politics. Just the other day, I received a letter from Amida. She was in Arica. Now she has come here. So those Arican people are very much disturbed. And she has become a sannyasin. So they have written a letter of expulsion. She is expelled. This looks nonsense. This seems to be politics. No, she cannot anymore be allowed to attend their meetings or to participate with them. In their jargon, they have said, "Now you are put in water." She is condemned. The same goes on everywhere. Scientology does the same to people. Once you are in Scientology and you leave it, just like as Amida has been put in water, they give a notice that you are an enemy now. Enemy. But this is how always it has happened. Always remember, wherever your mind is being narrowed, escape from there. It is not religion. It is politics. It is an ego trip. Religion widens you. Religion widens you so much that the whole house around you by and by disappears. You are just under the sky, absolutely nude, in total communication with the existence. Nothing exists between you and existence. This point is achieved easily, naturally, spontaneously at the time of birth. The powers are revealed at birth. Everything is revealed at birth. It is only a question of reclaiming it. It is a question of remembering it again. It is not going to be a discovery, it is going to be a rediscovery. Many people come to me and they ask, if samadhi happens, enlightenment happens, how we are going to recognize it, that it is that. I said to them, don't be worried, you will recognize it, because you know it what it is. You have forgotten. Once it happens again, suddenly in your consciousness, the memory will arise, surface, and immediately you will recognize. And this can be acquired also in four ways. The first is through drugs. Hindus have known drugs for thousands of years. In the West, the craze is very new. In India, it is very ancient. Patanjali says it can be acquired through drugs, repeating sacred words, mantras, or austerities, or samadhi. He is in favor only of samadhi. But he is a very, very scientific man. He has not left anything out. Yes, it can be acquired through drugs, but that is the lowest a glimpse of it, through chemicals. You can have a certain glimpse, but that is almost a violence, almost a rape on God. Because you are not growing into the glimpse, you are rather forcing the glimpse upon yourself. You can take LSD or marijuana or something else. You are forcing your chemistry. And if the chemistry is forced too much, for a few moments, it becomes loosened from the conditioning of the mind, from the tunnel-like style of your life, it becomes loose. You have a certain glimpse, but the glimpse is at a very great cost. Now you will become addicted to the drug. Whenever you will need the glimpse, you will have to go to the drug. And each time you go to the drug, more and more quantity of it will be needed. And you will not be growing at all. You will not be maturing at all. Only the drug will grow into its quantity, and you will remain the same. This is getting a glimpse of the divine at a very great cost. It is not worth. It is destroying yourself. It is suicidal. But Patanjali puts it there. That's a possibility. Many have tried that, and many have gone almost insane in it. It is dangerous to try any violence on existence. One should naturally grow. At the most, it can be like a dream, but it cannot be a reality. A person who has been taking LSD for long remains the same person. He may talk about new spaces that he has achieved. And he will talk about far out experiences. But you can see the man has remained the same. He has not changed. He has not attained to any grace. It may be otherwise. He may have lost any grace that he already had before. He has not become more happy and blissful. Yes, under the impact of the drug, he may laugh, but that laughter is also ill. It is not arising naturally. It is not flowering naturally. And after the impact of the drug, he will be dull and he will have hangovers and he will again and again seek the again and again he will be seeking and searching the same glimpse. Now he will become hypnotized with the experience of the drug. It is the lowest possibility. The second better than this is of mantra. If you repeat a certain mantra for a long time, that too creates subtle chemical changes in your being. Better than drugs, but still, that too is a subtle drug. If you repeat Om, Om, Om continuously, the very repetition creates sound waves in you. It is as if you go on throwing rocks in the lake and waves arise and they go on spreading and they create many patterns. The same happens when you use a mantra. Continuous repetition of any word, and it has nothing to do with Om, Ram, or Ave Maria, or Allah. It has nothing to do with them. You can do blah, blah, blah. That will do. But the same, you have to repeat same, with the same tone, in a rhythm. It goes on falling on the same center again and again and creating ripples, vibrations, pulsations. They move inside your being and spread out. They create circles of energy. It is better than drugs, but it is still of the same quality. That's why Krishnamurti goes on saying mantra is a drug. It is a drug, and he is not saying anything new. Patanjali says the same. Better than the drug, you don't need any injection. You are not dependent on any outside agency. You are not dependent on the drug pusher, because he may be not giving you the right thing. He may be handing you something bogus. You need not depend on anybody. It is more independent than drugs. You can repeat your mantra inside you. And it is more in tune with the society. The society will not object that you repeat Om, Om, Om. But if you take LSD, the society will object. Better, more respectable, but still a drug. It is through sound that your chemistry of the body is changed. Now, much experimentation is going on sound, music, chanting. It changes chemistry, certainly. A plant grows faster if it is surrounded by music. By a certain music, of course, classical or Indian. Not by modern Western music. Otherwise, the growth stops. Or the plant goes crazy. Subtle vibrations with great rhythm and harmony, and the plant grows faster. Almost the growth is doubled, and the flowers come bigger, more colorful, and they stay longer, and they have more fragrance. Now, these are scientific truths now. If a plant is affected so much by sounds, much more will happen to human beings. And if you can create an inner sound, a continuous vibration, it will change your physiology, your chemistry, your mind, your body, but it is still an outside help. It is still an effort. You are doing something. And by doing, you are creating a state which has to be maintained. It is not natural and spontaneous. If you don't maintain it for a few days, it will disappear. So that too is not a growth. Once a Sufi visited me. For 30 years he has been doing a Sufi mantra and has done it really sincerely. And he was full of vibrations. Very alive. Very happy. Almost ecstatic the whole day. As if in samadhi. Drunk. His disciples brought him to me. He stayed with me for 3 days. I told him, do one thing. For 30 years, you have been doing certain chanting. It stopped for 3 days. He said, why? I said, just to know whether it has happened to you yet or not. If you go on chanting, you will never know. You may be creating this drunkenness by chanting continuously. You drop for 3 days and just see, he became a little afraid. But he understood the point. Because unless something becomes so natural that you need not do it, you have not attained to it. And just within 3 days, everything disappears. Just within 3 days, a 30 years effort. And after the third day, the man started crying and he said, what you have done? You have destroyed my whole sadhana. I said, I have not destroyed anything. You can start again, but now remember, even 30 lives, if you repeat, you will not attain. This is not the way. After 30 years, you cannot go for a 3-day holiday. That seems to be a bondage. And it has not yet become spontaneous. It has not yet become part of you. You have not grown. These 3 days has revealed you that the whole effort for 30 years has been in wrong direction. Now it is up to you. If you want to continue, continue. But remember, now don't forget that any day it can disappear. It is a dream that you are holding through continuous chanting. It is a certain vibration that you are holding, but it is not arising there. It is cultivated, nurtured. It is not yet your nature. Third is by austerities, that is still a little higher than mantras. By changing your way of life. Not hankering for comfort, convenience, for food, for sleep, for sex. Dropping all that the mind naturally desires. And doing just the opposite. If the mind says go to sleep, the man of austerity says no. I'm not going to sleep. I'm not going to be a slave to you. When I would like to go to sleep, I will go, otherwise not. The mind says, you are feeling hungry, now go and beg. And the man of austerity says, no. The man of austerity says continuously no to his mind. That is what austerity is, saying no to the mind. Of course, if you continuously say no to the mind, the conditioning becomes loosened. Then the mind is no more powerful on you. Then you are released a little. But that has to be said continuously again. Even for one day, if you listen to the mind, again the whole power of mind will return back and dominate and possess you. So just a moment's going astray, and all is lost. The man of austerities is doing better. He is doing something more permanent than the man of chanting. Because when you chant, your lifestyle remains unchanged. Just inside, you feel good, a certain well-being. That's why Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's transcendental meditation has so much appeal in the West, because he does not ask you to change your lifestyle. He says, whatsoever, wherever you are, it's okay. He does not want you to make any disciplined life. Simply repeat the mantra 20 minutes morning, 20 minutes evening, and that will do. Of course, it will give you better sleep, better appetite. You will be more calm and quiet in situations where anger was easier, will not be so easier. But you have to continue every day the chanting. It will give you a certain inner bath into sound waves. It will give you a little cleansing. But it is not going to help you grow. Austerities help more, because your life starts changing. If you decide not to do a certain thing, the mind will insist to do it, and you go on denying the mind, your whole life pattern changes. But that too is forced. And people who are too much in austerities lose grace, become a little ugly. And constant struggle and fight and constant repression and saying no creates a very deep rift in their being. They may have more permanent glimpses than the man of chanting or the man who is addicted to drugs. They will have more permanent results than Timothy Leary and Mahesh Yogi. But still, it is not a spontaneous flowering. It is still not Zen, not real yoga, not Tantra or Samadhi. Then comes the fourth, which Patanjali has been trying to explain to you. Through Sanyama, through Samadhi, everything has to be attained. Whatsoever he has been teaching up to now is through Sanyam, Samadhi, bringing your awareness to it. The man of drugs works through the chemistry. The man of austerities works through the physiology. The man of chanting works through the sound structure of your being. But they are all partial. Your totality is not yet touched by them. And they all will create a sort of lopsidedness. One part will grow too big, and other parts will lag behind, and you will become ugly. Samadhi is the growth of the total, and the growth has to be natural, spontaneous, not forced. The growth has to be through awareness, not through chemistry, not through physics, not through sound. The growth has to be through awareness, witnessing. That's what Samadhi is. Samadhi will bring you to the same point when you were born. Suddenly it will reveal your being to you, who you are. Now, a few things about samadhi will have to be understood. One, it is not a goal to be achieved. It is not a desire to be achieved. It is not an expectation. It is not a hope. It is not in the future. It is here now. That's why the only condition for samadhi is desirelessness. Not even the desire of samadhi. If you desire samadhi, you are continuously eroding samadhi yourself. The nature of the desire has to be understood, and in that understanding it drops by itself on its own accord. That's why I say when your hopes are frustrated, you are in a beautiful space, use it. That is the moment where you can enter into samadhi more easily. Blessed are those who are hopeless. Let it be added to Jesus' other beatitudes. He says, blessed are the meek, because they shall inherit the earth. I say to you, blessed are the hopeless, because this will inherit the whole. How hope is destroying you, try to see it. With hope arises fear. Fear is other side of the same coin. Whenever you hope, you become afraid also. You become afraid whether you are going to fulfill your hope or not. Hope never comes alone. It keeps company with fear. Then between fear and hope, you are spread out. And hope is in the future and fear also in the future. And you start swinging between hope and fear. Sometimes you feel, yes, it is going to be fulfilled. And sometimes you feel, no. It seems impossible, and fear arises. Between fear and hope, you lose your being. Let me tell you one very famous old Indian story. A fool was sent to buy flour and salt. He took a dish in which to carry his purchases. He was told not to mix the two ingredients, but keep them separate. After the shopkeeper had filled the dish with the flour, the fool, thinking of the instructions, inverted the dish, asking that salt be poured on the upturned bottom. Therewith, the flour was lost, but he had the salt. He brought it to his boss, who inquired, "But where is the flour?" The fool turned the dish over to find it, so the salt was gone too. Between hope and fear, your whole being is lost. That's how you have become so much disintegrated, split, schizophrenic. Just see the point of it. If you don't have any hope, you will not be creating any fear. Because fear cannot come without hope. Hope is a step of fear in you. Hope creates the door for the fear to enter. If you don't have any hope, then there is no point of fear. And when there is no hope and no fear, you cannot move away from you. You are simply that which you are. You are here now. This moment becomes intensely alive. The second sutra, jatyantar parinama prakatya purat. The transformation from one class, species or kind into another is by the overflow of natural tendencies or potentialities. Very significant. If you are a man of austerities, you will not be overflowing. You would have repressed your energies, afraid of sex, afraid of anger, afraid of love, afraid of this and that. You would have repressed all your energies. You will not be in an overflow. And Patanjali says only through overflow is transformation. It is one of the most basic laws of life. Have you watched when you are feeling low in energy, suddenly love disappears? When you are feeling low in energy, creativity disappears. You cannot paint. You cannot write a poetry. Or if you write, your poetry will not walk. Dancing is far away. It will not even walk. It at the most will limp. It will not be much of a poetry. If you paint when you are low energy, your painting will be ill. It will not be healthy. It cannot be. Because it is your painting and you are feeling low in energy. In fact, the painting is you spread on the canvas. It will be gloomy, sad, dying. I have heard about one great painter who has asked one of his friends, a doctor, to come and see his painting. The doctor watched and looked from this side and that, and the friend, the painter, was very much happy that how much he is appreciating. Then he asked finally, because he looked that the doctor is looking puzzled, not even puzzled but worried. The friend said, "What is the matter? What do you think of this painting?" He said, "Appendicitis." He had made a portrait of somebody. And the doctor was looking from everywhere because the face so pale and the body looks in such agony that he felt must be appendicitis. Later on it was found that the painter had the appendicitis. He was suffering from it. You spread yourself in your poetry, in your painting, in your sculpture. Whatsoever you do, it is you. It has to be so. Flowers come into the trees only when they are overflowing. The energy is too much. They can afford. When a tree has not much energy, it will not flower. Because it has not energy even enough for the leaves. It has not energy even enough for the roots. How can it afford? Flowers will almost be a luxury. When you are hungry, you don't bother to buy paintings for your house. When you don't have clothes, you think of clothes. You don't think of having a beautiful garden. These are luxuries. When energy is overflowing, then only celebration, transformation. When you are overflowing with energy, you want to sing, you want to dance, you want to share. The transformation from one class species or kind into another is by the overflow. Ordinarily, as man is, he is so blocked. And there are so many problems repressed that the energy never comes to a point where it can overflow and just be shared with others. And your sahasrar, which is your flowering, your lotus in the crown of your head will not flower unless energy is overflowing. Unless it is so much so overflowing that it goes on rising higher and higher, the level goes on rising higher and higher, it reaches to second center, the third center, the fourth center, and whatsoever center is touched by the over-rising energy opens, flowers. The seventh chakra is the flower of humanity, Sahasrar. Sahasradal Kamal, 1,000-petaled lotus. That will flower only when you are in an overflow. Never repress and never create blocks in your being. Never become too much solid. Don't get frozen. Flow. Let your energy remain always streaming. That's the whole purpose of yoga methods, so that your blocks are broken. The yoga postures are nothing but just a methodology to break the blocks that you create inside your body. Now, exactly something like it has happened in the West, it is Rolfing, founded by Ida Rolf. Because in the West, the mind is more technological. People don't want to do their own thing, they want it to be done by somebody else. Hence Rolfing. The Rolfer will do the work. He will give you deep massage. And he will try to melt your blocks. The musculature that has become hardened will be relaxed. The same can be done by yoga. And more easily. Because you are your own master. And you can feel your inner being more rightly, accurately. You can feel where your blocks are. If you close your eyes and sit silently every day, you can feel where your body is feeling uncomfortable, where your body is feeling tense. Then there are yoga asanas for that particular body part to relax. Those asanas will help to dissolve the musculature there, which has become hardened, and will allow the energy to move. But one thing is certain, that a repressed person never flowers. A repressed person remains with damned energy, pent up energy. And if you don't channelize your energy in right directions, your energy can become destructive and suicidal to you. For example, if your energy is not moving towards love, it will become anger. It will go sour, bitter. Whenever you see an angry person, remember, somehow his energy has missed love. Somehow he has gone astray. Hence he is angry. He is not angry at you. He is simply angry. You may be just an excuse. He is anger. The energy is blocked and life is feeling almost meaningless, without any significance. He is in a rage. There is a very famous poem of Dallan Thomas. His father died. And on that night he wrote that poem. In that poem comes these lines: fight, rage against the night. Don't go silently into the dark. Rage, rage, rage against the night. Don't go silently into the dark. He's saying to his father, fight with death. Rage against it. Don't surrender. Don't just let go. Give a good fight. even if you are defeated. But don't go without a fight. If love is not fulfilled, one becomes angry. If life is not fulfilled, one becomes angry at death. A man whose life is a fulfillment will not rage against death. He will welcome. And he will not say it is dark night. He will say so beautiful, so restful. Dark is restful. It is almost warm, like mother's womb. One is moving again into the greater womb of God. Why rage? Those who have flowered, surrender. Those who are frustrated cannot surrender. And out of their frustrations they create more hopes. And each hope brings more frustrations, and the vicious circle goes on and on, ad nauseam. If you want not to be frustrated, drop hope. Then there will be no frustration. And if you want really to grow, never repress. Enjoy energy. Life is an energy phenomenon. Enjoy energy. Dance, sing, swim, run. Let energy stream all over you. Let energy spread all over you. Let it be a flow. Once you are in a flow, flowering becomes very easy. The incidental cause does not stir the natural tendencies into activity. It merely removes the obstacles. Like a farmer irrigating a field, he removes the obstacles and then the water flows freely by itself. Patanjali is saying that in fact, if you don't have blocks, everything will be attained naturally. It is not a question of creating anything. The question is of removing only the blocking. It is as if a spring is there and a rock is blocking its way. It is streaming behind it but cannot remove the rock. The spring, the water has not to be created, it is already there. You simply remove the rock and it bursts forth. It is like a fountain. You just remove the rock and it bursts forth, it flowers. The child has it naturally. You have to attain it by understanding. And you have to drop all the blocks that the society has enforced upon you. The society is against sex. It has created a block just near the sex center. Whenever sex arises, you feel restless. You feel guilty. You feel afraid. You shrink. You don't stream. You don't flow. The society is against anger. It has created a block there. So anger comes, but you cannot move into it totally. You will have to drop all these blocks. That's why I insist for dynamic methods. They will melt your blocks. If you are angry, scream. L. No need to L and scream at anybody. Just a pillow will do. Beat the pillow. Jump on it. Kill the pillow. There is no need to kill anybody. Just the idea that you are killing the pillow is enough. Just getting into the rage, into the anger, is enough. The block is broken. If you want to kill somebody or if you want to be angry at somebody, you can never be totally in it. Impossible. Because the other is going to be hurt, wounded. And you are a human being. You have compassion and love also. So one withholds. Beat the pillow. Have a good knife and kill the pillow. When the pillow is dead, bury the body and be finished with it. And suddenly you will feel something has broken inside you. A rock has been removed. L, jump, jog. And if sex arises, help it to arise. Forget all that the society has taught you. Enjoy the very feeling of sensuality arising in you. Cooperate with it. Don't shrink and don't resist it. Cooperate with it. And soon you will see that the sensuality is transforming. When the pool is full, it starts overflowing. Sensuality overflowing becomes sensitivity. People who repress their sex become insensitive, dull. They don't have life. They become wooden. The incidental cause does not stir the natural tendencies into activity. It merely removes the obstacles. The whole effort of yoga is to remove the obstacles. Vaya negativa. Nothing really is to be done because you have everything. Just it is not flowing. Few rocks have been put on the path. You have been distracted. It is just like a farmer irrigating a field. Have you seen a farmer irrigating a field? Water is flowing in one channel. He removes a little earth. The water starts moving into that path. When that part is irrigated, he puts a little earth back on the gate. The water stops flowing on that path. Then he opens the channel somewhere else. The water starts flowing there. Water is there. Needs channelization. Energy you have, you are. It needs simply channelization so it reaches to the Sahasrar, to the highest peak, climax of your being. Artificially created minds proceed from egoism alone. And we all have artificial minds. That's what I call the hypnosis that society has done to you. We have a group in the ashram and I have been thinking about it. It is called hypnotherapy. But I would like it to call de-hypnotherapy. Because the basic effort is to de-hypnotize you or un-hypnotize you. Uncondition you. All minds are artificially created minds. Nirmana chittani asmita matrat. Artificially created minds proceed from egoism alone. I am a Hindu. I am a Mohammedan. I am black. I am white. I am this, that. They are all artificial minds. The original face, the original mind, uncreated by a man, has to be known and realized. I have heard a little colored boy accidentally spilled a tin of white paint over himself. When he arrived home, his father gave him a good hiding and told him to go straight to bed. Sobbing his way out of the room, he said, "I have only been white for 20 minutes and I hate you blacks already." Even a 20-minute-old child has started accumulating the artificial mind. Even a 20-minute-old child looks at his mother with more love than towards anybody else, because he has learned one trick, the conditioning has started that sea is food and survival depends on food. So howsoever ugly the mother always looks beautiful. It is survival. And the child is starting learning diplomacy. He will not smile so much at the father. He does not know who this man is. He will learn it later on. By and by he will see that this man is important. Of course he is not seen very much in the home, but important. Rarely on Sundays he is there. But even the mother depends on him. Even the mother smiles at him. Then the child also smiles at the father. He is learning the artificial mind. He is creating relationships, arranging his survival, creating a situation, diplomacy, politics. But this artificial mind, which is a help in survival in the beginning, becomes the greatest problem in the end. Because when you have survived and you have used the artificial mind, then it hangs around you like a rock in your neck. It becomes the ego. It has to be learned. Nothing can be done about it. Every child will have to move into the artificial mind. But when you become alert and aware and when you start thinking and meditating about life, then it is time to by and by drop it and drop the ego. Because the ego is nothing but the artificial mind. The center of the artificial mind is the ego. And every artificial mind can be continued only if you go on enhancing your ego. Hindus will say that they have the greatest religion in the world. They are the most religious people in the world. In fact, if they are really religious, they will not utter such nonsense. Because a religious mind is humble, simple. This is ego. Then every country has its own ego. Then the Russian, the Chinese, the American, the German, the English, everybody has his own ego. And every country goes on feeling that we are the superb, the chosen. And every country finds ways and means to feel enhanced. And every race, every group, and every man and woman. I have heard the elephant looked down and saw a little, very tiny mouse standing by its foot. "Dear me," said the elephant, "you are very tiny." "Yes," agreed the mouse, "I have not been very well lately." Even a mouse has his own ego. He has been ill, that's why. The artificial mind lives through ego. So if you start dropping your ego, the artificial mind will start disintegrating. Or you drop your artificial mind, the ego will start disintegrating. And if you want really to get rid of this rock, start both the ways together. Never enhance the ego in any way. The ways are very subtle. Remember that the original mind is egoless. It does not know the I. Because I is a shrinking. The original mind is infinite. Like the sky. And one problem arises continuously as far as ego is concerned. In the beginning you try to befool others about you, but by and by you are befooled yourself. When you start convincing others that you are somebody in particular, you become convinced yourself. There was a strict rule in the mental asylum: no pets. The warder heard poor Harry talking to a dog called Rover and marched into his padded cell. There was Harry leading a tube of toothpaste round on a piece of a string. "What is that?" asked the warder. Harry looked at him in surprise. "Surely any fool can see it is just a tube of toothpaste on a piece of a string," he said. Satisfied, the warden left. Just as he closed the door behind him, Harry breathed a sigh of relief. "Good boy, Rover. We sure fooled them that time." The more you are trying to befool others, trying to prove that you are somebody in particular, exceptional, extraordinary, this and that, all neurotic ideas, but if you succeed in proving it to others, you will only succeed in befooling yourself. Look at the whole nonsense of it. Nobody is extraordinary, or everybody is extraordinary. Nobody is special, or everybody is special. But there is no point either way to prove anything. There is no need. Artificially created minds proceed from egoism alone. So if you want to come to the original mind, which is the whole effort of yoga, tantra, zen, then you will have to drop the artificial mind, the mind that has been created by the society and given to you, the mind that has been created from the outside and enforced on you. By and by, drop. The more you will see, the more you will be able to drop. Whenever you start feeling attached with the artificial mind, whenever you say, "I am a Hindu, and I am an Indian, and I am an English, and I am British," or this and that, just catch yourself red-handed. Deep inside a slap your face and say, "What nonsense." By and by, don't be defined by society. Then you will find the indefinable, your real, authentic being. Though the activities of the many artificial minds vary, the one original mind controls them all. So whatsoever your artificial mind, in fact, in reality, the original mind hiding behind them controls them all. Find the controller. Try to find who you are originally before the society corrupted you, contaminated you, before the society enters and planted you and destroyed your wilderness. In Zen they call it finding the original face which you had before you were born and which you will have when you will die again. The original face, untouched by society. That's your nature, your soul, your being. Finding the original face, you will be reborn. You will become a dwij, twice born. You will become really a Brahmin, one who knows. Then again, everything will be revealed to you as it was revealed at the time of birth, because you will be born again. But this time there is going to be a great difference. You will be alert. First time you missed, you will not miss this time. First time it had happened naturally, this time it will happen with your alertness, awareness. You will be conscious of it. You will see yourself reborn again, being born again, arising out of the past, out of the clouds and confusion, thoughts, prejudices, egos, minds, conditionings, arising out of them, virgin, pure. Then you will again see the power that you are, the being that you are. So first it happens at the birth, second it happens at samadhi. In between it can be managed by three methods: drugs, chanting, austerities. But those three methods are ways of deceiving, cheating. And you cannot cheat upon God. You can cheat yourself. Remember that. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.